Welcome to our final podcast in the area of public law and legislation at the University of Ottawa Law School. In the last podcast, we focused on the judicial role in reviewing legislative action. Here we turn our attention to judicial review of administrative decision-making as part of something called administrative law. In our session, this means judicial review of executive action on non-constitutional grounds. But a quick caveat, just so you're not misled by this focus. The executive, too, is bound by the Constitution, not least the Charter. If in the course of exercising its powers, almost always powers delegated by the legislature through statutes, the executive transgresses, say, a charter right, it, too, is reviewable, and often that review takes place through the same process associated with judicial review of administrative action. But as I say, our focus in this podcast will be on non-constitutional bases for courts to interfere in the exercise of power by the executive branch. So start with the basics. We know from our British parliamentary tradition that it is Parliament and not the executive that is sovereign. Accordingly, the executive has limited power, and its power is limited to three fundamental sources. First, the residue of the monarch's power known as the royal prerogative. Second, those scanty and limited provisions in the Constitution Act of 1867 that bestow power upon the Governor General and the Queen, for example, appointing senators. And third, the most important source, the power which has been delegated to the executive by the legislature. And while in the U.S. there are strong constitutional disciplines governing how much power can be delegated by the legislature, in Canada we are much less concerned about the scope of delegated power. And with a very few number of exceptions, there are few constitutional constraints on what sorts of powers can be delegated to the executive. And we've talked about this, and we've talked about those constraints. And so this is all old news to you by now. Now, we saw also that Parliament and its provincial counterparts have, in fact, delegated massive amounts of power to their respective executives. So much so that it is fair to say we are really governed by the executive. And yet, though the executive has been delegated so much power, that does not mean that the principle of parliamentary supremacy is no longer applicable. Outside of the Constitution itself, Parliament and its provincial counterparts remain the source of all legitimate legal authority in our system. And this is true also in terms of the court-made common law that you study in your other courses, since it too can be displaced by legislation. Accordingly, if the executive purports to exercise power that is not accorded to it by the prerogative, or the Constitution Act of 1867, or by the legislature via delegation, the executive acts without jurisdiction. And to use a common Latin expression in this area, it is said to act ultra vires, which translates into outside of the scope of. And if it acts without jurisdiction, the executive acts without any lawful authority. And to allow the executive to act without lawful authority would undermine another of our important constitutional principles, the rule of law. All power exercised by government must be authorized by law. And so to ensure that this rule of law standard is met, that all power is exercised with lawful authority, we rely on the courts to police the executive. It is the courts who ensure the executive remains within its piece of the power pie, the one that it's been accorded by law. And this policing job is known as judicial review on administrative law grounds. And while there is no express mention of this role in the Constitution, this policing job of judicial review has come to have a constitutional dimension. And truth be told, the courts have been much, much more active in this area of judicial review of administrative action than they have ever been reviewing the legislature on constitutional grounds. Here, with judicial review of administrative action, there is little conflict between parliamentary sovereignty and the role of the courts. In fact, in policing the actions of the executive and ensuring that the executive is abiding by the terms by which power was delegated to it by the legislature, the courts, in employing the common law doctrines of administrative law, are enforcing and preserving parliamentary supremacy. They're making sure that the executive remains subordinate to the legislature. So let me repeat basic principles. All the meaningful powers of the executive are delegated to it by the legislature. All the meaningful powers exercised by the various departments and agencies of the government exist by virtue of delegation. Because these bodies exercise only those powers given to them by statutory grant, their powers are constrained by the scope of this grant. The delegate must be able to demonstrate that their actions fall squarely within the powers given them by Parliament. And if they are not, then the powers are beyond the jurisdiction of the delegate. They are said to be ultra vires. It is the courts that supervise whether the delegate is exercising its powers properly. And with judicial review, here the courts do not have the power to substitute their views on the merits of lawful action taken by the delegates. Instead, judicial review is limited to determining whether the delegate has acted strictly within the powers that have been delegated to it. So next, those basic principles then go some way to explaining where does this review power come from? The superior courts in Canada have the inherent jurisdiction to supervise the legality of actions taken by the executive. This is a common law power, and it is often justified with reference to the rule of law and to parliamentary supremacy. With respect to the rule of law, it is justified by the view that the law is supreme and power cannot be exercised arbitrarily. So you, member of the executive, you better be able to point to law authorizing your use of power. And you, member of the executive, you are subject to the jurisdiction, as would anyone else. With respect to parliamentary sovereignty or supremacy, the courts argued that if they were not to review the exercise of delegated power, then in essence, the delegates would have absolute discretion, would have absolute authority to exercise power not given them by the legislature. And in that context, the legislature would no longer be supreme. So to maintain the hierarchical relationship between the executive and the legislature, the courts have to police the boundaries of delegation. And so they police these boundaries at common law. And the Supreme Court has gone so far as to suggest that Section 96 of the Constitution Act of 1867 constitutionally preserves the court's capacity to do this job. Okay, now let's add some more detail. What is it exactly that the executive might do causing the court to intervene? Because it is very, very far more complicated than simply saying, hey, you're outside of your piece of the power pie, executive branch actor. Well, at common law, at its most basic, there are classically a number of things a delegate, that is, an executive official exercising almost always delegated power, could do that would cause them problems with the court. And these things can be divided into two broad classes because the legal tests applied to them vary according to these classes. The first thing that the delegate might do, these things amount to substantive errors. The second thing are things that the delegate might do that amount to procedural errors. So, substantive errors. This is the most basic, but in practice often the most confusing area. The starting point is that all delegates have to conform with the statutes that give them power. But then there are common law glosses that have been added to this basic principle. So articulated at the most basic level, there are essentially four types of substantive error. First, being outside a delegate's jurisdiction. They only have powers to make decisions within the bounds of the authority delegated to them. Sometimes a statute specifies that to have jurisdiction, certain things have to be true. You, the tribunal, have jurisdiction if the person is over 21 and from Canada. If the person is not over 21 and not from Canada, then the tribunal has no jurisdiction. Second, errors of law. You, the delegate, have to interpret questions of law correctly. If you don't, you're outside your piece of the power pie. Now, in practice, errors of law and errors of jurisdiction are blurred together. And really, errors of jurisdiction are a subspecies of errors of law. You misconstrued the law that gave you your powers. Third, abuse of discretion. No matter how broad the jurisdiction given to the delegate, no matter how sweeping the choices they're allowed to make, the courts will find that they exceed their jurisdiction if they abuse their power. And so, for example, in the classic common law, where the delegate acts in bad faith or for improper or irrelevant purposes or the like, in other words, no matter how sweeping the power the delegate might be delegated, that power had to be exercised for the right reasons. The court felt empowered to inquire into these reasons because they refuse to assume that Parliament intends to delegate power that the executive can then turn around and then say exercise in bad faith. Four, errors of fact. If you make an egregious error in your fact finding, well, then we'll intervene, says the court. You're outside your piece of the power pie. Now, once upon a time, these errors, these so-called grounds of review, were separate and distinct. But something happened beginning in 1979 in a case called CUPE. It's the acronym, CUPE, C-U-P-E. The Supreme Court became concerned that it had to accord the executive some measure of deference. It had to be gentle in its reviewing. That sometimes the executive is better equipped to perform its functions than courts are to review them. Sometimes tribunals and other executive decision makers are experts, much more so than the generalist courts. Perhaps the generalist courts should be deferential to these expert individuals and their own assessment of the powers given to them by Parliament. Perhaps the courts should be reluctant to intervene too readily on judicial review. And at about the same time, statutes began to include so-called privative clauses, that is, provisions that emphatically tried to limit or even eliminate the administrative judicial review authority of the courts. These were and are particularly commonplace in labor relations statutes. But courts were unprepared to take these privative clauses literally. To do so would remove the courts from their constitutionally proper role of ensuring that the executive remains within its piece of the power pie by not exceeding the powers given to it by the legislatures. But nevertheless, the courts had to pay some heed to these privative clauses. They couldn't ignore them completely. So instead, they took and take the presence of a privative clause as a signal that, like expertise, perhaps they should be deferential to the executive's decision-making. And so in response to these sorts of considerations in the area of substantive judicial review for substantive errors, the court developed a complicated test that incorporated concerns about deference. Not every error of law, for example, would knock the delegate outside of its piece of the power pie. The test that would be applied first with error of law and then for the other grounds of review for substantive errors is now called the standard of review analysis. In its basic contours, it is set out in the Dunsmuir case in your materials. It takes several weeks in administrative law to cover because there are wrinkle upon wrinkle in terms of complexity. But for our purposes here, suffice to say that the standard of review test is used as a means to determine how much deference should be accorded to the executive in making its decisions in individual cases. And where deference is owed, the courts have said, well, we'll only consider you to be outside your piece of the power pie, that is, to be acting unlawfully, if you acted in an unreasonable manner. And if no deference is owed, we simply consider whether your decision was correct or not. And so these are the standards of review, the standard of unreasonableness versus correctness. And what they mean in practice is that where a court determines it will scrutinize an executive decision using the unreasonableness standard, it will be more forgiving of that decision. It will have to be more than wrong in the court's eyes. It will have to be so wrong it is truly unreasonable. And what that means in practice requires a lot of time in administrative law courses. And even then, you will probably come out of close study on this topic dissatisfied by the absence of real precision. Okay, so that's substantive errors in a nutshell. Moving on to procedural errors. The key issue here is what's known as common law procedural fairness, or the older parlance, natural justice. And so procedural fairness. The executive generally has to meet something called the rules of procedural fairness. In rendering a decision, it has to act in a procedurally fair manner. Now, the question of what fairness requires depends on the facts and circumstance in each case. At minimum, however, fairness requires that before a decision is made, a person should be told of the matter and should be given an opportunity to respond, and the decision should be made by an unbiased decision maker. Beyond that, there is no fixed content to fairness. The court will determine what was fair in the circumstances. Generally, the more serious the possible adverse consequences of the decision for the individual, the greater the procedural protections. And so when you study administrative law, you will find that there are basically two big legal issues in the area of administrative law procedural fairness. When does it apply? And what are the precise procedural protections that must be observed? First issue, when does it apply? Is what I call the trigger question. When is procedural fairness triggered? This used to be a very complex area. Now, the answer translates to almost every instance in which the executive is exercising power which affects the rights, interests, or privileges of identifiable individuals. The second issue, which is what is the content of procedural fairness, is still very complex. And as I've suggested, considerations like how serious is the decision to the affected person plays a role in deciding how robust the procedural protections must be. And you see this in several other considerations driving the Supreme Court of Canada's reasoning in the leading case in this area, Baker. Okay, moving on to our last issue in this podcast. What can the court do if it finds one of these errors, either substantive or procedural? At common law, when the court found a delegate had not abided by the instrument delegating power, where the decision contained the flaws I've just mentioned, there were five orders it could issue, called prerogative writs. And there are really three that remain important. And there are a couple others that have been added over the years, but I'm going to focus on the three that remain most common. First, something called certiorari. This is an order quashing the decision of the delegate. So a court may quash or expunge a decision that has been made without proper authority, but it may not issue the actual order that the delegate could have made. And so the court cannot step into the shoes of the delegate and issue the decision the delegate should have made. Almost always this is the case. Instead, it will quash the decision, which in many cases means the delegate is then in a position to make the decision over again, this time properly. Second, prohibition. This is an order barring the delegate from coming to a decision. A court may stop the delegate from taking a specific action that is not authorized to be taken by a statute or another legal source. Such an order from the court will issue only where the tribunal clearly lacks authority to proceed. Third, mandamus, an order requiring a delegate to perform a statutory duty that has been delegated to it. In other words, the court here may order a tribunal to perform a specific act, but only if three preconditions are met. First, the applicant must have a legal right to have the act performed. Second, the delegate must be under a legal duty to so act. And third, the delegate has been asked to act by the applicant but has refused. Now, in many jurisdictions, including Ontario and at the federal level, the common law judicial review process has been modified by statute. And so if you have a beef with a decision at the federal level, you may bring something called an application for judicial review to the federal court. And the procedures for judicial review is established by statute in the Federal Courts Act. And almost all applications for judicial review are brought to the federal court itself. There are a handful that go directly to the Federal Court of Appeal. If your beef is with the Ontario Executive, you'll end up before the Ontario Divisional Court, pursuant to an Ontario statute called the Judicial Review Procedures Act. Okay, that's it. That's all I'm going to try to accomplish on administrative law in this introductory course. So that's our short form discussion of administrative law. And that's also the end to all the material in this course. In our practices, of course, we'll play with some of these ideas and we'll also do a review of the course through a hypothetical. But this ends all the new material for this introductory study of public law and legislation. So I thank you one final time for your time and your interest through the sequence of podcasts, and I wish you luck in your studies and in your career. Thanks very much.